Ku Iluna. Please rise.
Ua ho'o malolo ia mai ne kea aha ho'o kolo kolo ki iki hana hana. This Honorable Supreme Court does now reconvene. E noho ilalo, please be seated.
Please call the case.
Case number SCWC-22-129, State of Hawaii versus Patrick H. Oki. Arguing for the petitioner defendant appellant Patrick H. Oki, Taryn R. Tomasa, Deputy Public Defender. Arguing for the respondent plaintiff appellee, State of Hawaii, Brian R. Vincent, Deputy Prosecuting Attorney. Argument on the merits.
All right, good afternoon, aloha everyone. Our proceeding today is being broadcast live on the Judiciary's YouTube channel as well as on Olelo. I'd like to welcome our substitute justices, Judge Jeanette Castagnetti and Judge Gary Chang, and also want to acknowledge Judge Chang. He'll be retiring on June 1st after 25 years of service to the judiciary. So thank you, Judge Chang. Counsel, are you ready to proceed today?
Yes, sir.
All right. Just to confirm, Ms. Tomasa, you have 30 minutes for both sides. Ms. Tomasa, you're going to go 25 minutes with your initial argument and reserve 5 minutes for rebuttal, correct? Yeah. Mr. Vincent, we're going to give you a warning with 5 minutes to go. Please proceed.
Thank you. Good afternoon. Deputy Public Defender Taryn Tomas on behalf of Petitioner Appellant Defendant Patrick Oki. And good afternoon, Chief Justice Rechtenwald and associate members of the court.
Maybe pull the mic just a little bit right so it's right in front of you. Sorry.
There are three questions presented to this court. One, whether a new restitution hearing must be had where Oki 1 changed the restitution payee to Spire. Oki paid Spire $576,720 for losses resulting from this from his thefts, and that amount was never considered by the court. There is a factual dispute as to whether restitution is reasonable and verified. Two, whether the ICA erred in holding that Oki waived as opposed to forfeiting his scheduling claim and failed to review that issue for plain error. And three, whether Act 231's repeal of theft by computer is applicable to Oki. The answer to each of these questions is yes, and I wanted to start with the third question. The issue of whether Act 31 is applicable to Oki is whether this court believes that it is reasonable for Oki to serve 20 years in prison for conduct that the legislature declared is not criminal. It was not a crime when the state tried Oki. It was not a crime when the circuit court convicted Oki, and it was not a crime when the circuit court sentenced Oki to 20 years of imprisonment. It is not reasonable, but in fact, the convictions in counts 8 and 9 are illegal. The generic savings clause used in Act 231 is ambiguous as to the terms proceedings and penalties incurred. The term proceedings in the generic savings clause has been interpreted by this court as ambiguous in State v. Avila. Proceedings can mean prosecutions, but also when looked at in the context of the relevant act, it can also mean proceedings related to bail proceedings. And it's this doubt, doubleness of meaning, or indistinctiveness and uncertainty that is the ambiguity. At the same time, this court has held that the same term proceedings as it appeared in State v. Reese is unambiguous, meaning the initiation of criminal prosecutions against the defendant. At the same time that Reese held this, it also held that unambiguous terms can become ambiguous when examined in the context of the act, and it referred to Avila. In this case, in the context of Act 321, which was an omnibus crime bill, 44 pages long, 10 parts, and 72 sections, the legislature repealed the offense because it was unjust and imposed an unduly harsh penalty, and it is within this context that it can mean trial, conviction, or sentencing. Trial, being the beginning of the answer as to whether Oki's conduct fell within the ambit of the offense and the repeal. Proceedings should not be interpreted as a prosecution in the context of this case and Act 231.
Ms. Tomasso, you referenced the omnibus bill, and Section 70 is the savings clause aspect of it. It has some meth carve-outs. If the ledge wanted to foreclose prosecutions and sentencings for 708, 893 matters or those crimes before July 31st, 2016, why wouldn't it have included that language in Section 70?
So I believe that the legislature did exactly what Reese and Avila told it to do. It said, give context, and that's what it specifically did. The exceptions that are listed in the Act 231 are distinguished by drug offenses. They're not a theft or property crime, as in this particular case. Given the breadth of Act 231, it would have been unreasonable to expect the legislature, beyond what it already did in its compliance to Reese and Avila, to carve out exceptions for each provision that it changed or amended or repealed. The legislature was very specific as to its intent to repeal this, that it was unjust and unduly harsh. I don't think that it's reasonable for that one savings clause to be applicable as to everything that occurred inside of that act, given the breadth of it.
But the legislature, I guess, by carving out the meth offenses, showed that it apparently understood what the default rule would be otherwise, and was very explicit in carving out these offenses and saying even if the new regime of not having meth trafficking unless you're trafficking to a minor or you're manufacturing, and instead having promoting dangerous drugs as the applicable offense, very specific about how that would apply. So the ledge appears to know how to carve out an exception to the general rule of how these provisions are read that we articulated in Reese. What's your response to that?
If the court takes those exceptions as the end-all and be-all, then the court would also be ignoring the mandate that Reese and Avila imposed, that there has to be a contextual analysis as to whether, as to the meaning of the statute, of the savings clause, whether proceedings is ambiguous, and the context of it is that it is ambiguous given what the legislature gave us.
What about in terms of the savings clause, it says penalty incurred or proceedings begun, right?
Yes.
So in Reese, this court said that a penalty is incurred at the time of the commission of the offense, right?
Yes.
But it also said proceedings are when the complaint or the charge is brought, right? So
yes.
Let's say that this act occurred before July 30th of 2016, according to Reyes, then the penalty incurred would be the 20 years, right? But if the charge was brought after July, I'm sorry, let's say that the act occurred when it did, right? Let's say it was in 2015, but the charge was not brought until 2016, then which is it? The statute savings clause says, if you apply Reyes directly, it says the penalty incurred would be 20 years, but the proceedings begun would be, if this charge was filed after July 30th, it would be 10 years. So which is it? Isn't there an ambiguity there?
So, you know, my position is that Reese is limited because even when it held that the penalties incurred phrase meant when the prosecution was initiated.
It said when the act occurred, when the prosecution was initiated.
When the act occurred.
Right.
It also limited, saying that that was in the context of that particular act. I believe it was Act 44. And so if there is this ambiguity, I would urge the court to employ the rule of lenity to interpret the language strictly against the state and in favor of the defendant. And because this is a remedial statute, this court has held in State von Gelderden that remedial legislation is to be construed liberally to accomplish the purpose for which it was enacted. And here it was to repeal the offense because it was unjust and excessively punitive.
As compared to the special savings clause for the meth offenses, which was to actually not make it remedial, but to incorporate, to make it actually make it a little bit harsher.
Yes.
It made it harsher. I thought it allowed probation. So wasn't meth trafficking one like there's a mandatory minimum? And the ledge basically said, unless it's dealing to kids, we want it to be promoting dangerous drugs, so there could possibly be probation or no minimum sentence. Maybe I misunderstood. If you could correct,
I think there were amendments going both ways in this bill, so that there were some that were imposing more severe penalties for those who were deemed to be dealing, and then there were a reduction of penalties or making offenses probationable should it have been a possession user type of offense.
I thought it was dealing unless you're dealing. I thought it ameliorated the or gave the opportunity for probation to those who were dealing other than to kids. In other words, it said, hey, you're dealing to kids or you're manufacturing, then it's going to be meth trafficking. That's a very serious offense. But otherwise, you have the possibility of probation. Perhaps I misunderstood.
I may stand corrected, Your Honor.
I think it had an ameliorative effect. It's trying to give people the opportunity for a lesser sentence, what I understood.
To the extent that there are these intents that were articulated in Act 231, the same is true for this particular statute, the theft by computer, in which they did say that the intent was to repeal this unjust offense due to the harsh consequences and penalties. And because of that, we are asking that this court liberally interpret the savings clause as applicable to Oki, and that his trial and sentencing and conviction occurred within the time after the act became in effect, and to not interpret it as prosecution or the initiation of prosecution. The term proceedings, when you just read it in the plural, the plain meaning seems to be an act or step within a larger action, as opposed to if it was in the singular, that would designate a particular time, point in time. The filing of the criminal action, the proceeding has started. In addition, there's nothing inside of the act that defines proceeding as being defined as the initiation of the prosecution. We know that if the legislature intended it to be prosecution, they could have used that particular term, as they have done within the statutes. For example, in 701, 108, the time limitation, that statute uses prosecutions. And so we're asking that proceedings be liberally construed and...
Well, but doesn't that go against... Reyes? I mean, aren't you really essentially asking us to overturn Reyes in that sense?
If the court would like to take a step back from Reyes or to overturn Reyes, because there are some inconsistencies within that decision, that would be something to consider. But I believe under Reyes or Avila that Oki's claim prevails, because Reyes itself refers to Avila, indicating that the contextual analysis needs to be done.
Yes, you know, Reyes said that the penalty is incurred upon the commission of the act. Has a penalty actually been incurred upon the commission of the act, even among as a plain meaning. I mean, so if what to me doesn't make sense, if the penalty was incurred upon commission of the act, then it's 20 years. But it also says it doesn't apply to proceedings that were begun before its effective date. So it would apply to proceedings that were begun after its effective date. So this could have been charged after July 30, 2016, and then it would be 10 years. So it just seems to me that there's just a real internal inconsistency in the savings clause. The savings clause itself does not seem to make a lot of sense. But you are basically arguing that we should consider the ameliorative effect despite what Reyes said.
Yes, and Reyes is holding that the penalty is incurred at the time of the commission of the offense goes against the presumption of innocence that remains with an accused unless and until they're found guilty. And so the holding that Reyes employs is really contrary to that presumption. That's another reason of its internal inconsistencies that, you know, we disagree with Reyes.
You know, I want to follow up something with Justice McKenna asked earlier, and it revolved sort of the interplay between incurring penalty and prosecution begun. Let's say incur penalty is as Reyes says it is, and that means when an act is committed, when a crime is committed, and prosecution begun means when a prosecution is initiated. Now, you could have on both sides of the July 31st, 2016, or whatever the effective date might be, you could have incur penalty here before the effective date, but then the prosecution could begin after the effective date. Does that create ambiguity between those words of the savings clause?
I think that's the internal part of the internal inconsistency, and it does create the ambiguity.
And I know it didn't happen in this case because Oki, you know, both things happened before. But it strikes me, in listening to what Justice McKenna was floating there, that that might create an. It's your position that creates some of the ambiguity, combined with the ameliorative effect and intent of the law, that just creates one big ambiguity, and then we can get to your lenity point. I don't want to put words in your mouth, but is that what you're pretty much saying?
Yes. And so any ambiguity is going to direct us to the rule of lenity to strictly construe the law against the state and in favor of the defendant.
But wouldn't we do that only in that circumstance where penalty is incurred prior to the effective date and prosecutions afterwards? In other words, we would give the defendant in that case the benefit of the ameliorative effect of the statute or the rule of lenity, but why give it to Mr. Oki, who by it, if you believe, is it Reyes or Reese? I'm not sure. I'll say Reese, sure. But you know, it was both his criminal conduct, alleged criminal conduct occurred before and his prosecution was initiated before. Why is there an ambiguity in his case?
Because when you read the statute and you see that it was repealed and you're just, you know, and then you see the charge, there is like, does this apply to him? Does the repeal apply? That in of itself is the pause is saying that there is some ambiguity as to whether it applies or not. And then when you read the savings clause and it says proceedings that commenced, well, what really constitutes proceedings? And we know that reasonable minds can disagree about what the savings clause said and specifically proceedings. And that's evident through Justice Wilson's and Judge Wadsworth's dissents related to these cases.
I noticed that on this motion to correct illegal sentence, no constitutional issues were raised. Is that right? You didn't argue cruel or unusual punishment.
No, I believe that was raised in Oki 1.
It was argued as cruel and unusual punishment, was it not?
I can't confirm
that's
that.
That's what was argued, but that's not what our Constitution says. It says cruel or unusual punishment. So what would happen if a motion was brought based on the proper constitutional provision. The legislature has said that it's unduly harsh.
I believe that he would have a viable claim under cruel because of this excessive punishment, especially given the fact that our world is so computerized and any of our conduct, should we have engaged in something mistakenly or if we committed theft with our phone, in our car, all of these things have computers that would qualify underneath the definition. And so I think it would constitute cruel punishment under our Constitution. I'm not sure how much time I have, so I wanted to go to my second issue.
19 minutes in, so you got a
little time. Thank you. So the second point of error is that the IC erred in holding that Oki waived as opposed to forfeiting his scheduling claim. It is our position that waiver requires an intentional relinquishment and abandonment as opposed to forfeiture where you can stand silent. We're not asking for anything new in this point of error, but just for clarification on forfeiture. Because Oki did not waive his scheduling claim, he did not raise it below at the trial court, but he did not waive it. Hence, on appeal, it should have been addressed as plain error, having been raised for the first time on appeal. And if we apply the plain error standard, the circuit court failed to comply with the statute. That's a due process violation that impacted Oki's substantial rights. And so should we prevail on this? We're just asking that the court clarify that waiver requires an intentional relinquishment as opposed to forfeiture, which the person can stand silent. And then on appeal, it would be addressed with plain error, which is a very high standard in and of itself. And then finally, for my third point, a new restitution hearing must be had. The court can re-examine the appropriate restitution because the ICA's analysis was based on the mistaken belief that Oki never challenged the amount of restitution, and he did repeatedly. He had challenged it in both his opening and reply brief in Oki 1, as well as his answering brief to the state's appeal in the same case. It is clear that after Oki had engaged in the thefts that he worked for Spire, and because of a promissory note that was executed, Oki ended up paying Spire $576,720 for the losses that were related to his theft. So Oki 1 never contemplated Oki's payment to Spire because at that point it was just whether the partners and PKF were entitled to it. And so given Oki's payment directly to Spire, a factual dispute exists as to whether any verified and reasonable restitution amount is owed to Spire. And if there aren't any other questions, I'll just save my remaining time for rebuttal.
I have a question going back to your forfeiture versus waiver issue.
Yes.
You know, you're saying that a forfeiture happens if the party in court fails to raise an issue, and that is a forfeiture of that right, not a waiver.
Yes. Correct.
In general, evidence jurisprudence, isn't it usually said that if a party does not object to evidence, that the objection is waived, not forfeited?
Yes.
How would you reconcile that use of the word waiver in the context of your appeal?
I think it's just a lack of clarification of the two terms. I think years ago, the same problem happened when on appeal, you know, judgments would be vacated or reversed, and the two terms became interchangeable. And I believe that without the clarification, the two terms in state law has become interchangeable. And that's my response to that.
Very well. Anything further?
Nothing further. I'll save my remaining time for rebuttal. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Tomasa. Mr. Vincent.
Thank you. I'll just go ahead and start with the issue on the computer crimes. Can you hear me okay? I noticed that you've been having a hard time hearing people. One thing I didn't note in my brief, but I was looking at just today, and I came across it by looking at Dominguez, right? And that was the OVUI law that was repealed, and then the new 291E subchapter was enacted, right? And they mentioned that in that case because the state conceded that HRS 1-11 did not apply in that case, and that's a very specifically related to prosecutions. Let me read the language of that statute. It says, no suit or prosecution pending at the time of the repeal of any law for any offense committed or for the recovery of any penalty or forfeiture occurred under the law so repealed shall be affected by such repeal. So I think that the statute deals directly with the issue we're here today, and they use specifically prosecutions. So in this case, 290 Act 231 would not apply to any case except for the methamphetamine cases that were commenced by a charge before the enactment of this statute. I don't know. That case seems dispositive. That statute seems dispositive to me. I had a couple other statutory interpretation arguments I would make if you want to hear them, but
that was 1-11.
Yeah, 1-11. Yes. And if you remember, they found that that barring the reason why it did not apply in Dominguez was the old OVUI law had been repealed. And there was no savings clause in the act. And we initiated the prosecution under the old law after the enactment of the repeal of the old OVUI law. If we had begun the proceedings before the enactment of the new law, it would have been protected by HRS 1-11. Well, I'm going to talk about some of my other statutory interpretation arguments. I guess the first one is that this whole statute or whole act was enacted at the behest of a penal law review committee. It had 29 members, of which probably a couple of dozen were lawyers, and everybody was represented. There was four circuit court judges, two ICA judges, and one Supreme Court judge, Justice Pollack, was chaired by my now boss, right, Steve Holland. And it also was, there was also representatives from there was also six attorneys from the defense bar. They made it specifically so that there was as many defense bar attorneys as there was prosecutors on the committee. And none of them apparently thought to put this, put a clause in here that would make it retroactively effective to cases that were, you know, either conduct occurred before the statute was repealed or restarted after, before the statute was appealed. So I think there's a strong presumption. I think there's a stronger presumption than in many cases, in this case, that the people who drafted this law knew exactly what the law was, and they could have, as they demonstrated, they knew how to do in the act for the methamphetamines laws. They could put an act a section in there that would have applied it to the acts.
I want to kind of go back to your initial argument.
Yes.
You're saying that HRS 1-11 would control in any event.
I would think it's a statute, and it would control over case law.
So let me ask you this
law.
Then. If there were two defendants and, you know, that they were doing the same thing. Mm-hmm. And then the state chose to charge one on July 31st and charge one on August 1st.
Yeah, that's...
You think the statute would completely control and we wouldn't have to consider any constitutional implications?
To me, it makes more sense making it the time the penalty was incurred, because that's more or less out of control of both the defense bar and the prosecutor, right?
Oh, even though it says it doesn't apply to proceedings that were begun, which connotes that it does apply to proceedings that were begun after.
Yeah, that's what the statute says, and that's what the rule is. So,
you don't think that the specifics savings clause would affect the effect of 1-11?
Well, I think that this controls. Okay, this is the statute, and this was the legislation.
So you're saying that the savings clause as to the meth offenses is ineffective then, because you're saying the statute controls despite what this law says, this specific law says.
Well,
you're saying that the legislature can't have a savings clause that is retroactive.
Maybe it is. I don't know.
So the statute does not control.
Well, I guess it does control, but nobody's here challenging the meth laws, the enactment of the repeal of the, or the change in the meth laws.
All right. So we should be looking at this savings clause to see what it really means.
Yes, I think it's important.
And do you think Avila is still good law? Do you think Reyes overruled Avila?
I mean, this law has been in effect since 1859, and I think relatively unchanged probably since then.
Is Avila good law?
With respect to the problem, or what? I guess Avila is probably not good law either. Yeah.
I'm sorry.
I guess the prosecution was started in Avila, correct? After, or
it related to a bail proceeding.
Right. So it had. I forget whether.
And it said that proceedings could mean different things depending on the circumstances.
Yeah, I think that's some of the analysis in Avila and Reese probably has to be rethought.
Yeah. So, are you arguing that Reese overruled Avila? Because it didn't expressly say so, and in fact, it said that if there's an ambiguity, you would look at what was specifically being addressed.
I guess I haven't thought about that particular thing. I mean, I just discovered the statute as I was preparing for this argument this morning.
Would the more specific statute govern? In other words, the legislature spoke in this particular.
I guess there's a statutory construction presumption that the more specific controls over the more general. That's correct.
Okay, so
I think this statute lends credence to the idea that if it was not specifically contradicted in the act, that the statute would apply.
What's your answer to the question of is there an ambiguity created when, in an instance where a defendant committed the offense prior to the effective date, but the prosecution wasn't initiated until after the effective date?
What happened in Dominguez. And there was no specific savings clause in Dominguez, and they found that statute had been repealed and was not effective anymore. And then they found another way around it, a substantial reenactment argument.
There was no specific savings clause in Dominguez?
In Dominguez, no.
So talk about how you think this one should apply, if you could.
I think it should apply to all those sections where it was not specifically. No.
The hypothetical that Justice McKenna posited, a defendant who commits the offense prior to the effective date of this act, which I believe was July 11th of 2016, offense is committed prior to that date, but the prosecution is initiated after that date. Does that defendant get the benefit of a more liberal rule set forth?
I still think it's the date of the conduct, the controls.
And why is that?
Because the I guess the hypothetical idea of our law is that each person commits acts knowing the consequences, or deciding what how they're making their decisions based on what the law is. Okay, the law is everybody's presumed to know the law, right? So if you're outside a convenience store and you're thinking about whether to go in and rob the convenience store, your culpability is based on everybody's, I guess, hypothetically deemed to know what the consequences of their acts are, okay, at the time they commit them, not what might happen later after they commit them. So I would suggest that the most fair way of determining this thing is just to say that the conduct that's the subject of the offense is...
This savings clause does say penalties incurred, proceedings begun, rights or duties are matured, right?
Right.
Nothing had matured yet, right? So penalties incurred.
Yeah.
How do you respond to the defense's argument that what happens to the presumption of innocence if you say that the penalty has already been incurred at the time the act was committed, even if there had been no prosecution?
Because as Reese notes, there's a difference between penalty incurred and penalty imposed. So you incur the penalty when you commit the act. It's only imposed after you've been found guilty beyond a reasonable doubt and you've been sentenced. So that's a distinction that's made in Reese. And I think that's a distinction that's followed in the majority of the states that Reese recited to. I think there was about 14 cases which agreed with their position and
so
one that did not.
That is not, it's not the case here. So then how do you reconcile that with a proceeding that was brought after the effective date? An act that occurs before the effective date, but a proceeding that is brought after the effective date.
Well, I think that when it speaks about the let me look at the savings clause here. So it does not affect rights or duties matured, penalties incurred, proceedings that were begun. I think this is a list of things, and the earliest date controls, and in this case, it would
in
be
all circumstances.
Incurred.
So the rule of lenity would not apply. There wouldn't be an ambiguity.
I think it was that kind of language is a very general language that's put into every enactment.
Let's say that this, some reason, that this prosecution was initially dismissed. The initial prosecution was dismissed and then refiled after the effective date.
HRS 111 would not apply, but I still think that this statute, that the specific savings clause would apply because the penalty was incurred before the amendment of act was enacted.
Counsel, what does the word "and" in Section 70 mean between penalty and proceedings?
Well, "and" is included within each, I guess, phrase, right? So, rights and duties matured, comma, penalties that were incurred and proceedings that were leaked. So I would think that it's not a...
Do all three need to happen?
I don't think that all three have to happen in order
so
not to apply.
The state gets the benefit of the end?
Well, I
rights and duties that matured. You concede that that has did not happen, right?
Yeah, I mean, rights and duties that were matured, I don't know if it really applies to a criminal case. And I think that's why
it's in a criminal statute.
It is. But I mean, legislatures tend to take things from other acts and put them in. And then in acts that may not, where there may be some irrelevant language. Or
how do you respond to the defense's argument that proceedings that were begun connotes there can be different proceedings, despite what Reyes said?
Yeah, that was the issue in Avila, right? Well, where they there was a ambiguity between bail proceedings and prosecutorial proceedings. That ambiguity doesn't exist here because we're not talking about bail proceedings. And I think this
Reyes
court
was factually distinguishable, right? It wasn't a sentencing that was, it wasn't a,
I think it was a sentencing.
It was, the issue was whether or not the defendant could be charged as a first-time offender, right? Under a new law.
Yeah.
This court held that he couldn't. He had a prior conviction, so he couldn't be treated as a first-time offender.
Right. And he couldn't receive probation. Yeah, that's correct. And
the trial judge was
my boss.
Your boss.
No,
right? You held that he could.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah, and he disagreed with us, obviously. So, but he was on this committee, so I would think that if anybody, he would have been aware of that case, and he would have put a savings clause in there.
Do you think this whole thing about the legislature is aware of our court, this court's rulings, actually makes a lot of sense?
Yeah, I've some academics question that.
Well, but most lawyers are not aware of our precedent,
right.
So I'm sort of shocked that the legislature is presumed to understand our precedent. But anyway, let me ask you this. If you look at the intent of Section 70 of Act 31, it's no trials for 708, 893 offenses. Intent of Section 70 is, no prosecutions. It's no sentencing. I mean, basically, you're just erasing this crime from the books. So if there's that intent, clear intent by the legislature that we don't want this crime prosecuted, then how does the proceeding mean, proceeding begun, how does that mean at the initiation, the prosecution begun? I mean, it just seems like, to me, it's more like the Avila situation here, because in Avila, it was a targeted bail pending appeal situation. Mm-hmm. Here, it's a targeted, don't charge these people. I mean, so it just seems that, well, the intent's clear. And despite the savings clause, the intent is clear in the whole legislation itself that we just don't want these things prosecuted. So
he was charged before the enactment of the statute. Mm-hmm. So if the legislature had wanted us to say, okay, any cases that are pending with this charge need to be dismissed, they could have done that. And they could have done that in Section 7.
I mean, how does that comport with fundamental fairness? I mean, just in the sense that, you have, let's say the act goes in effect. Let's just say hypothetically there was a crazy law in the books in the HRS that gave life to life. That's the sentence for whatever the conduct was. And then the legislature, after seeing people sentenced to life after life, is, upset. We don't want this to happen anymore. So they pass a law just like this, same stuff, same savings clause, everything. And basically there's an interval, because when an act's passed, there's, a time frame. And in that time frame, your former boss or your current boss, former judge, then just, I don't like that law. I want all these guys to get life. And they file dozens and dozens of charges against these people. Those people then would go to jail for life, despite the legislature's clear intent that they do not want these people to go away for life?
Well, my personal... my answer to that is that if the defense bar thinks that it should not apply, they should go over to the legislature and petition them to do that over there at the legislature and not come here to try to get this court to change.
But is there a difference between a law that maybe tweaks some meth crimes, maybe adds a little punishment, less punishment, whatever, versus a law that just totally scraps a criminal offense that the legislature is saying, we don't want this to happen anymore? It just strikes me that there's a difference between that situation and all the other permutations we can, you know, conjure.
Well, the rationale that you cite would apply equally to the various theft statutes where they raised the dollar threshold. To my knowledge, nobody has challenged any of those statutes. I'm sure that there are people that were charged who are alleged to have stolen $301 before the enactment of the statute and still got convicted for theft in the second degree, right, which is a felony, right? Whereas now it's after the statute, it's just a misdemeanor. And I guess that brings me to my second point about statutory instruction, and that is that generally statutes should be construed so as they don't create unconstitutionality in the statute. And not all the provisions of the statute are ameliorative. In fact, some of them raise the penalties. For example, Section 36, the habitual property crime, they reduce the number of prior offenses to qualify for a Class C felony. If this act was applied to that section as applied would be unconstitutional. And there's a couple other ones, 44.
The way I look at some of these savings clauses, and it seems like the legislature uses the same darn thing every single time. It's like they cut and paste whatever they want to say on the savings clause, because the Villa 1988, that's the same thing as, well, today, with at least Act 231. And it seems like that's just sort of their go-to, this is what we'll do. And it strikes me, I started thinking about, you know, savings clauses, and they're really kind of, you know, we don't have ex post facto in our Constitution, but it is in 1-3.
It's a federal requirement, though, so it would be a violation of federal constitutional law.
Right, but it seems like savings clauses are almost akin to ex post factos, and ex post facto laws are, generally speaking, designed to protect a person from, you know, getting an elevated offense, for example, or an elevated penalty or something. In other words, the conduct's committed, but the ground rules there somehow change, and we don't want that to happen. And it seems like that's what savings clauses are designed to do, to almost sort of provide some procedural protection or some protection to a defendant. And it seems that what the legislature was doing with Act 231 was they were trying to protect people who were possibly going to be charged with this crime. And I guess what I'm asking is are these savings clauses in your minds akin to a ex post facto clause protections?
Well, no, it would not, if it was applied to only those sections which were ameliorative, it would not be run afoul of the ex post facto clause. But then I guess, do you just create an assumption by case law that all ameliorative provisions are just automatically retroactive applicable, but not the ones that are aggravating, that there are great offenses that didn't exist before or harsher offenses?
Well, isn't the rule of lenity kind of based on due process principles? Like, you know, if something's ambiguous and it's unclear, then laws are supposed to be construed in favor of the criminal defendant.
I mean, again, there's a presumption that, you know, like there's a presumption, true or not, legislators to know the law, and I guess they're presumed to know, you know, HRS 1-11 and generally and Reese and the other cases that provide.
Well, the specific savings clause would apply here, not 1-11, right?
Yeah, and personally, I have no idea why they didn't just put a clause in here that affected all cases. I don't know.
A villa. Yeah. And they thought that we would rule
it doesn't.
In favor of a criminal defendant.
I mean, who knows? Reasons for it, there's reasons not for it, I guess.
Can I ask a question? It relates to Judge Wadsworth's dissent in the ICA. And here's what he wrote to justify his position. In light of the legislature's remedial purpose in enacting Section 42 and abolishing the offense of using a computer to commit theft, I conclude the term proceedings, as used in Section 70 and applied to Section 42, refers to trial and sentencing proceedings begun after the act's effective date. Do you have any response to what Judge Wadsworth wrote there to support his position?
My position is that it doesn't apply to cases that where penalties were incurred. I think the conduct is an important point.
So we don't even factor in the fact that it's a remedial-based statute or ameliorative.
I think not. Yeah. If you want to have a solid rule that the legislature will be aware of what it is, you know, and will conform their legislation to that requirement.
Do you want to talk briefly about restitution?
Yeah. There was no ability to pay. Hearing held here, and I not particularly opposed to remanding it for that. I do think that $30 a month is not unreasonable. So with respect to the amount, that was proved beyond a reasonable doubt at trial. So the amount, $440,000, so many dollars, I think there's no need to have a hearing on it. It was already decided by the jury, by the trier of fact, I should say. It's the first time I'm hearing about him paying some money to Spire. I think Oki's position was he was just stealing from himself. That everything, he was the main shareholder in this partnership, and that he wasn't even really stealing from himself. He was just taking money that belonged to him, but, you know, surreptitiously from his partners. But so I don't know what's going on with Spire. The trial deputy who handled this is retired now. I don't know what the status of the any potential restitution payments is. But the bottom line is that, you know, until he gets out of jail, his restitution is basically statutorily defined by 533-26 or something. So there's no discretion in the circuit court to decide ability to pay while he's in custody. It's only after. So, and I don't know how. I don't know how the basis, I don't know how a judge is going to determine what his ability to pay is in 3-4 years from now. It's hard to say. I don't know how accurate they're going to be at this time. But it seems to me it would be better if they just waited until after he got out of custody and decide how much he can pay. Anyway, that's all I have to say.
All right.
Yeah, thank you.
Thank you for your argument. Ms. Tomasa, your rebuttal.
Just briefly with respect to the restitution, you know, I was trying to look through it. I wasn't the trial deputy who handled the matter, but I've seen the $576,720 amount being articulated by Oki previously, and I think it was in context of Oki 1, but I know that that is in the record, and that was the basis for him requesting a new restitution hearing. we do agree that the more specific savings clause is what is applicable, that the ambiguity in Act 231, that savings clause needs to be addressed first before you even get to 1-11. And even if you get to 1-11, that this court has in the past applied statutes retrospectively and interpreted and given broad saving statutes as used in this generic savings clause a narrow reading so as not to deprive the defendant of the benefits of new legislation. And we're asking that this court do so just as Avila did. It should liberally construe in order to prevent the injustice from continuing. And so at the beginning of each legislative session, the legislature does take an oath to uphold the Hawaii Constitution.
Can you put the mic closer in front of you? I'm having a hard time hearing you.
To do what's appropriate and undo what's necessary. And that's what they did in this case. They repealed the statute. They gave context in Act 231, as Reese and Avila said to do. And the fact that the committee that prepared the report and did the amendments were composed of lawyers, judges, and a former justice indicates that they did know Avila, they did know Reese, and that's what they did. They provided the context. And so based on that context, the legislators stated that they were appealing because it's unjust, unduly harsh, especially in our modern world, and hence, no one should serve the 20 years or any time because the conduct is not criminal. Oki's 20-year sentence is illegal. It's not reasonable. And we know that in the context of Act 231. So we are requesting that the case be remanded to vacate and dismiss counts 8 and 9 and that a new restitution hearing be had. And if restitution is ordered, that it comply with 706-646. Thank you.
Well, thank you for to both counsel for your arguments today. The court will take this matter under advisement.
In ku iluna, please rise. Ua ho'o ku'u ia mai ne kea aha ho'o kolo kolo ki eke hano hano o ka mokaina o Hawaii. This Honorable Supreme Court of the State of Hawaii is now adjourned.